Hi, welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Stephen McHattie, an actor you'll have seen in pretty much everything. His dozens of feature credits include Pontypool, Watchmen, A History of Violence, and Secretary, and his TV credits range from Starsky and Hutch, Hill Street Blues, Miami Vice, and Seinfeld. I know, right? To runs in The Strain and the final season of Orphan Black. He next plays a key role in Peter Lynch's Birdland, which opens theatrically in Toronto and launches on VOD in the US and Canada this Friday, January 26th. Stephen chose The Searchers, John Ford's 1956 Western, which became the director's defining collaboration with his star John Wayne. A bleak, grim story, shot in VistaVision and Technicolor, it casts Wayne as Ethan Edwards, a Civil War veteran bent on finding his young niece after she's abducted by a Comanche raiding party that slaughtered the rest of their family. Edwards' motivations, which are gradually revealed to be horrible, and his open loathing for the Indians he's chasing, offered Ford an opportunity to embark on one of the earliest deconstructions of the genre, a film that none too subtly blurs the lines between its ostensible heroes and villains until we're left with nothing but an endless chase, an endless cycle of violence, and bloody, awful revenge. Also, Natalie Wood and Jeffrey Hunter are in it. This is someone else's movie.
Well, it's a movie I saw when I was a kid, because my dad loved John Wayne. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it, but it kind of scared me. I didn't really know what it was about. And then I watched it in New York when it was when John Wayne had completely gone out of fashion.
Right.
Everybody hated John Wayne, or everybody that I knew. You know, I was kind of struck by how beautiful it was, but didn't really get into it. And then I saw it again when I was in my 40s, and it started to dawn on me what it was about.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I watched it about 10 years ago, and I just watched it again last night.
Oh, great.
So it's been something that's been kind of followed me around, kind of tugging on my sleeve. And now I think it's the best movie I've ever seen. In so many ways, especially now, it seems even better.
Yeah, I had seen it, I think the first time I saw it, I was probably about 15.
Yeah.
And I've seen it three or four times theatrically over the years. I just rewatched it last night, and it's amazing because it is such a studio picture. It's bound by all the rules of the 50s. They couldn't really show very much.
Yeah.
The lighting is very harsh, and it feels like a studio production in a way that movies wouldn't 10 years later.
And the big orchestra.
Yeah. And the themes that
and
run
the
through.
Presentational performances.
Mm-hmm.
Except for John Wayne.
Yeah, in the middle of it.
I think he's the best actor ever.
It's remarkable,
in that movie.
That performance. There is so much rage and pain, and it's all that he's constantly putting up this false front of confidence and bravery. He's an old, scared man that can't say so. And I don't even know that Wayne is aware of it sometimes, but it's such an incredible, weird take from him.
Yeah, but to me, you know, he's got what's in every man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary to look at that. And he's the first rebel.
Yeah.
I mean, he's rebelling against everything. Against Christian values, against the norms of the times, you know, what they think they're doing.
Yep.
Their conception of family, and he was with the Confederates.
That's right, yeah. It's not even, I mean, now I think something like that would be hit a lot harder, the concept of the guy having fought for the South and having lost.
Yeah.
And it's really just, that's part of his past. Everything is part of his past. The the suggestions about his life and who he used to be.
Yeah.
They're floating underneath the surface, but they never come through.
Yeah. But I don't believe there's ever been a more convincing dad guy than John Wayne.
Yeah. And he's the hero.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's about a mission of vengeance. It's about rage and hate and the tiniest step of overcoming lifelong racism. And it's so complex. And it fascinates me in terms of his filmography and his work with Ford, because, you know, the standard boilerplate critically is that they saw something in each other that no one else ever did, and they brought something out.
Yeah.
But this film is almost the master thesis of that argument, because you have this expert filmmaker, someone who, you know, what was their first collab? Was it Stagecoach was the first time they worked together, right? That was 39.
I think so, yeah. I'm not really up on that.
Yeah. But 20 years later, they're doing, or not even 20 years later, they're making this movie with just this total confidence and this complete trust in one another.
Yeah.
And it's such an ugly film. I mean, what it's about is so horrible, and the loathing that Ethan Edwards carries in himself constantly.
Yeah, but it's reflected back at him by Scar.
Yeah.
I mean, they're, you know, very similar figures.
Mm-hmm. Neither one really willing to understand the other.
Yeah, but I love the way it kind of, you know, because now our view is, you know, the guilt of, you know, having taken North America.
Sure.
Right? And this sort of describes what the fight was about, that it was a fight.
Yeah.
It wasn't a capitulation. The way it's talked about now.
Right.
You know.
No, it was, again, it was uglier and more brutal than anything people are willing to think about now. Or even, I was trying to think of equivalents. Everybody's talked about revisionist Westerns and where they go next, and after Unforgiven, the path that takes. But Unforgiven doesn't have anything to do with First Nations or with the colonization of America. It's all done by that point.
Yeah.
This is set roughly around the same window of time, maybe 15, 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, the Civil War was a distraction. They've gone back to murdering people and pushing west and colonizing and driving out the natives. And that results in this and the terror of miscegenation that runs through the whole thing. Jeffrey Hunter explaining early on that he's an 8th Cherokee. That's what they tell me.
Yeah.
And him feeling like he's an outsider, which is incredible because he was this beautiful poster boy from the 1950s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who is supposed to have an uneasy relationship with Ethan. Don't call me uncle. Don't call me sir. He just can't bear the sight of him in the beginning, and then slowly wins him over.
But that really, you know, because he does bequeath everything to him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, his father-son relationship, right? Of, you know, accepting him, even though he's, what is he, 1/8?
Yeah.
Indian.
So he says.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so much about family, too. You know, because in that first scene, when he comes back, right, it's not a sentimental homecoming.
No, everyone's really uneasy.
Yeah, and they also hate each other. Yeah. I mean, they're a real family.
Yeah, that's true. They don't know how to talk to each other. And it's all very tense, and he doesn't recognize his brothers and nieces.
Ahead of time that's to stay there.
With Yankee dollars, which is another statement that like they're both sort of disgusted that this is their currency.
Yeah, but they'll fight to the death for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really about, I mean, it's about so many things, but it's about country and family. And what it is to be a man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that everybody's got that deadliness in them, but now we're trying to pretend that we can legislate it away, you know?
Yeah.
And we can rewrite the past.
I think certainly everybody wants to. I mean, isn't it preferable, right? Wouldn't you rather have the version of your past that you...
No.
No.
I wouldn't.
No. Nope. There's definitely an urge, I think, that we constantly come up against, the idea of soft selling our own selves, not necessarily nationalistically, but just people. You know, like everybody wants to remember themselves as winning every argument. Everybody wants to be the hero of their own story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The temptation is there, and it just gets bigger. But the thing about The Searchers that I come back to, this viewing again, every time I see it, it's more ambivalent than I remember. Every single time, there's something else that's uncertain.
Yeah. There are so many just startling scenes in it that surprise me every time. Mm-hmm. You know, like the mention of when they first... realize they're about to be, the war party is coming.
Oh, at the homestead, yeah.
Yeah. And the daughter's reaction when she starts screaming.
It's huge. It's such a big moment, and it isn't immediately, but then every other...
But it makes the point, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you feel it.
And every other character carries that forward, the idea of violation, and not just of the home, but the, you know, how does Ethan put it? When she comes of age for whatever, and he won't say it. But and part of that, I always think, if it's 1956, of course they couldn't get into detail. But the way they imply things is so uncomfortable and unpleasant. Characters physically recoil from the news. And
That's the other thing about John Wayne's performance. I don't think I've seen a performance where you feel an actor's physical presence in every move he makes.
Mm.
I mean, you can just, he's like three-dimensional in everything he does.
Yeah.
And the way he's positioned in scenes. And he doesn't ever, you know, like in the scene where Jeffrey Hunter is, where with the will.
Yeah.
Where Jeffrey Hunter is in a rage with him. He says he doesn't want it, right? And he's really attacking him, right? John Wayne never gives any indication that it has any effect on him. None.
Yeah. Well, this is what I mean about him putting up the front all the time. He's just such a... He's so consciously being a brick wall.
Yeah.
Like Ethan will not reveal any emotion with his family. Like even the scene where he says... At the very beginning, it looks like you haven't grown at all. It's the kind of thing you think sounds good, but doesn't. It's just a terrible thing to say to a child.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure out this time, it's like, was he kidding? Does he know it's a different kid? And I think he's just so awkward that he doesn't know how to talk to children. He's clearly never had them in his life. He doesn't
know what to do. No, I think it's I kind of read it as a... I mean, I kind of grew up with that from adults.
That sort of joshing?
No, a kind of refusal to be sentimental.
Oh, okay.
You know, to indicate emotion that you don't really feel, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like now people kind of go way too far the other way.
It's overly demonstrative.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's simply treating them in a...
I'm like me, you're you.
Transactional business.
It's always going to be that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a good way of not letting anybody in if you're him.
Yeah.
Because clearly the thing that I caught it maybe the second last time I saw it, but early on when the little girl is leaning against the tombstone, that's his wife, I'm pretty sure. Mary Edwards died at the age of 40, 41.
Oh, yeah.
And never spoken, never discussed.
Ooh, I never caught that.
But that's what brings him back. I think that's the only reason he comes back. It's not for his family. It's for the grave. It's for that connection to his...
Yeah, it's about...
life that might have been.
Ideals. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then to expand on the theme of the film is that this entire movie is about a quest to find and kill his niece, who has been defiled by the end of it.
Yeah.
And that the great moral triumph of the movie is that he simply doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It always surprises me. I know it. I've seen the film. I know it's coming. And it always lands like a blow because somehow, the joke about if you A friend of mine loves to watch Midnight Express. He has to finish it because Billy might not get out this time. He has to make sure everything's going to be okay for him.
Yeah.
The joke about somebody going to see Rocky because, you know, like, he might win this time.
Yeah.
This, the idea that that's fraught, that there's any tension left in this film that I know well enough.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie's not going to change. But somehow Wayne makes that suspenseful. Ford plays it up in such a way that there's tension every time, and Natalie Wood is just so good at projecting that vulnerability the moment she sees him.
Yeah.
It could go either way every time I see it. It's a fascinating, weird thing that happens.
Yeah. And there's that primal scene of the, when he chases her down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
He's on horseback and she's running, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you watch that, you know, it's the hunter and the hunted, and the, of course he's going to kill her, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly carries it. I mean, he's moving like a Terminator. He has no, there's no indication of remorse or conscience. He's just, this is the thing. This is what his life has become.
Yeah.
And how can he, what does it mean if he doesn't follow through? And then, of course, oh yeah, he's one of the guys who lost the war. He knows what defeat feels like.
Yeah.
And to turn it into a moral victory somehow, like, I don't know how the film plays that in a way that feels human instead of moralistic. You know, it just structurally, you can't have John Wayne kill a teenage girl. That's a given. That was never going to happen, especially in 1956.
Yeah, in that movie, you believe he would.
Yeah. By the time we get to that point, we're. Anything can happen.
Yeah.
It's, I don't think it's a spoiler to mention that the other movie that you suggested covering was The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Yeah.
Which suggests a certain continuity.
Yeah.
But the use of Wayne in that is so completely different that he's just this quiet cynic who's also a gunfighter.
Yeah.
But the way that Ford saw him and understood him and used him as a contrast to the other actors, I just think there's something to the two films that I've said it already, they got each other in a way that nobody else did.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and he kind of takes the, when you're looking at this, you know, John Wayne in group scenes,
mm-hmm.
right? He's always, his attitude is always one of, look at this bullshit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he's always slightly apart.
Yeah.
He's the leader, but he doesn't put up with anything.
Yeah.
Like, he'll take the, he'll, it's because he pulls the eye, too, I think. He's such an interesting physical figure.
Oh, yeah.
He's this, you know, he's this beefy, broad physical space that gets filled.
Yeah. Yeah,
and in Liberty Valance, contrasted to Stewart, who's this beanpole.
Yeah,
it's a great image. But in The Searchers, mostly he's paired with Hunter, who is this classic model-looking guy.
Just, yeah,
you know, he's almost perfect.
Yeah.
In a distressing way for 1956. You think about Ricky Nelson in Rio Bravo too.
Yeah,
it just, directors delighted putting him next to idealized men.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Just to show the contrast that this guy, Wayne, has been around, he's lived, he's got calluses, and then you think about how, you know, Jimmy Stewart actually went to war in the 40s and
mm-hmm.
Wayne didn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah, they're just different interpretations. I mean, John Wayne was kind of perfect at being imperfect in that American West way. He's a frontiersman, he's not a cowboy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was it like as a kid seeing that? I mean, did you...
God. Well, my dad would always take me to these movies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved them. So I kind of tried to be enthusiastic about them. But I didn't... You know, it was more the... You know, because the... The action is so spectacular
mm-hmm.
with the horses and the Indians and the, You know, I think it's more caught my eye as a show.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't think I ever got that he was actually going to kill her.
Okay.
I think that went right over my head. Yeah. It's a little hazy as to what I felt.
Yeah.
Because I was pretty young when I went to see it.
Yeah. Those experiences, though, they're so formative. I'm fascinated by how people engage with culture when they're that little, because you don't really... I mean, I was the same way when I was a kid. My defining moments were things like Star Wars when I was 9, and
yeah,
there'd just never been anything else like it. It's fascinating now to watch the newer films try to tap into the same things just through use of film grain or music, and I'm having those lights go off in my head that connect me to that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I came to The Searchers a little bit later, and most Westerns...
When did you first see it?
I was probably around 15.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I had seen
it... On TV?
It would have been, yeah, or maybe on tape, but yeah, on video. I didn't see it theatrically until...
And how'd you react to it?
I liked it. I got it, I think. But I didn't get the revisionist aspects. I didn't get the questioning. It felt like a Western.
Yeah.
And I'd seen a few others at the time. My grandfather owned a movie theater down on Queen Street, the Orpheum.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Until I was... sold it in 77. So I was... Yeah, I was 9. And we didn't... I think the only vaguely Western-ish movie I saw there was March or Die, which I was far too young to see. It's a Gene Hackman Foreign Legion thing.
Oh, yeah.
And I only have this vague memory of watching it through the projection booth window.
Mm-hmm.
But I had seen... I think my experience... I know I'd seen... The most complex Western I'd seen was probably Winchester 73, the Jimmy Stewart movie. But I didn't understand it. I know that. Like, I saw it again when it finally came out in widescreen on Laserdisc in the late 80s. I saw it then and thought, oh, now I get it. This is a much more complex movie than what I thought it was.
Oh, yeah.
The Searchers was sort of in the middle of my understanding of Westerns, but I didn't really understand. I knew what it was about. I understood all the stuff that isn't spoken, all the implied threats and the miscegenation and the rape and all that. But it wasn't until I saw it again that I really got into it. Because I think it was just at the end of that wave, the VistaVision Technicolor wave, where everything just looks a little fakey. Even though they shot it in Monument Valley and locations, the colors are a bit too bright and a bit too rich. And you just, when I saw it on TV, it just felt like a TV Western. And then I saw it theatrically, and it's like, oh no, that's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You're supposed to sit in the dark and really think about the ramifications of these decisions and what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And that's what it does that a lot of other movies didn't do. It lets things sink in just enough that you understand the kind of existential horror that the story is about. It's about, on one level, it's about a bigot losing his family to rape by the other. That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, there's the idea that Ethan is clinging to this quest as the one thing that he can do that is decent in his mind. Mm-hmm. And what decency means to him.
Yeah, it's his search for himself, too. Yeah.
And in the end, the fact that he can't do the thing he has vowed to do and most wants to do, which is a horrible way to live, that's his redemption.
Mm-hmm.
But it keeps him... I mean, that beautiful final shot. He won't go in the house. He knows that's over.
Yeah.
It's just... Yeah.
Yeah. A complete redo of the first shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Just the idea that after all of this, in what he insisted was in service to his family, that he'll just divorce himself from that forever and just be outwards and outside for the rest of his days. It's just, it's so primal and so painful, and it's somehow a happy ending too. Like it may not be what he wants, but it's what he thinks he deserves. And that's something that took me years to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just such a...
And what do you think? Do you think he's justified?
Do I think he's made the right decision? Or that's it, right? What is justification in this world where life is is short and brutal, like nasty British and short, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, these people don't live very long and they don't live very well. I think there is something more satisfying of in the ending of this than in something like The Shootist, which was supposed to be big summation of everything of John Wayne's career.
Yep.
It's already done. The Searchers is Wayne. It, maybe he doesn't know it, but the movie knows it. This is who he is. This is what his legacy is.
Mm-hmm.
It's to be on the outside. It's to be the Avenger, not the Holmesman.
Yep.
He doesn't get his happy ending. This is as happy as he's going to be.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Eastwood gets in Unforgiven.
Yeah.
That it never goes away.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you can't spend most of your life riding a horse and shooting people and then just say, no, I'm a good
also,
guy.
Also, there's a thing of, you know, you can't give it up.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've been in those kind of situations, you can't leave. You got to find them over and over again.
Right. So it's not that the life won't let you go. It's that all you know is the life.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's like people who've been to battle talk about it being the best time of them, some of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are the guys you don't want to be around too long. You just... I don't know. I've having been lucky enough to never face war or even real, you know, battle, any kind of scuffle, I can't imagine wanting to. But maybe when I was 20, it would have been a different experience.
Yeah.
Because you do start to do the math and try to figure out how old Ethan was when all this started. And if he lost his wife at 40, that means they were together for a while, presumably. Because in the West, or in the 1800s, I don't think people got married. People did get married pretty young.
Yep.
Who was he before? And does it even matter?
Yeah. Well, he was in the war.
Yep. But as an older man, right? Because if it's the 1860s, it's 1868 when we meet him.
Yeah.
So he's just come back. But, well, no, sorry. They actually say that. You know, like, where were you for 3 years? The war's been over.
Yeah.
And he was probably just running around
Kansas
killing people.
Or something, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, the ones who never gave up. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, the hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
But then that gives you a different man as well. One who grabs onto this family quest because it gives him meaning or because it's a license to keep killing. And either way, it's because there's nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Well, if somebody's constantly trying to kill you, which is the situation the family's in, right? Some of them want to fight back. Some want to hide. And some want to take the fight to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not much different today.
No. Well, now it's just done with words.
Politicians.
Yeah, words and threats and immigration bans. And
tweets.
Yeah, tweets. Well, fortunately, tweets have a much lower kill ratio than bullets.
Yeah.
Yeah. You do. I've been trying to figure out how to contextualize The Searchers as a Western, because it is a Western, but it's a Western that's in conversation with all the ones that have gone before.
Yeah.
And then you see the ones that came after, like Unforgiven and that Ron Howard one, The Missing, that sort of does The Searchers, but compresses it.
Oh, really?
It. Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Tommy Lee Jones and Cate Blanchett. No one remembers it. It came out in 2004, I think.
Oh.
And it's not great, but it's really interesting in the way that it engages with, specifically with The Searchers, because Jones is playing Wayne.
Yeah.
But the idea is that in this case, he is brought into it by Cate Blanchett's character, who's his daughter, when her children are abducted.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about re-engaging with all that stuff. And it was sort of dismissed as an Unforgiven knockoff, but it really is more of a conversation with The Searchers and what that's saying about, and how it's, how attitudes and filmmakers have changed in the, what it would have been, 50 years since The Searchers, because Jones's character is a frontiersman as well, but he's gone native. He married a Lakota woman, and that's where he's coming from now. She comes to him because he's a tracker, but he's also a great a former soldier.
That's a long way from Ethan Edwards.
It really is, yeah. And then even further away is a Zacharias Canucks movie from a couple of years ago. I guess it would have played TIFF in 2016, Maglutit, which was his version of The Searchers, in which a native family is shattered by another native party, and it tracks it in about 1902 in the tundra. And yeah, it's really something. And it doesn't riff completely on Ford's film, but it's indebted to it in a way that's really interesting. Like, it never goes away. This movie is such a primal story that it's still bouncing around the culture.
Yeah.
We're re-engaging with it in different ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, those are worth seeking out. I recommend them to anybody listening as well. Because that's what we do.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of... In terms of Wayne and the Searchers itself, is there any part of it that has made its way into your work? Do you ever find yourself drawing on it? Is it somewhere in your creative DNA?
Well, I wish I could find a way into that.
Yeah.
But not that I'm aware of, no. No. It's such a different world. And the way the actors are used in that, you know, because Ford gets them all pumped up to be very theatrical.
Yeah.
Right? Except for John Wayne. Yeah, in Cheyenne Autumn.
Uh-huh.
Right? It starts out very presentational and very, you know, proscenium arch almost.
Mm-hmm.
Very theatrical. And the women are operatic.
Okay.
And the women he casts as the native women are, it's outrageous.
Really?
By
present
you're
standards?
You're just watching the act.
Okay.
Is all you're doing, right? But it gets more and more realistic as it starts dealing with the cavalry.
Okay.
And then it goes off at the end of the first, you know, it's a 4-hour movie, I think. At the end of the first act is an incredible scene in a bar with Jimmy Stewart. It's unbelievable. It's about 15 minutes long.
Okay.
And he keeps introducing these great character actors. And the scene builds and builds. It's unbelievable staging and acting. You got to see that scene.
Yeah, I've never seen the film. I'm excited to look it up.
It was kind of hard slogging.
Yeah.
So
this is like 64, right? According to the IMDb, it's one of those. I think so.
Yeah.
One of those roadshow pictures that we're doing.
Yeah,
at the time.
And it looked like a movie. He didn't have the money to do what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because some of it is on sets and. You know, it looks like, you know, he had huge ambition, you know, for a great big horse opera.
Right.
But cut back. Huh. But that scene with Jimmy Stewart, it's brilliant.
Oh, wow.
You got to watch it.
Yeah, it's going on the list. That's fantastic. And I love... as surprising as it may seem, I love finding out that there's stuff I haven't seen, because... You know, there's still time.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's on Blu-ray and see it properly.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, too. I mean, it's the same with The Searchers. It really wasn't until I saw it theatrically and properly
mm-hmm.
that I could even start to get into it. I can't imagine what it was like for that generation that grew up in the 60s and 70s just watching stuff on TV because it wasn't accessible anywhere else. Now,
I mean, oh, yeah.
People don't know how good they've got it, but there's still holes that need to be plugged and stuff that needs to be found.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's...
Yeah, I grew up in Wolfville, Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great theater there.
Oh, so you did have access.
Oh, it was unbelievable. He showed... Al Whittle showed... it's the Acadia Theater. Showed 3 movies a week, you know, with full shorts.
Right.
And newsreels and all that. Yeah. Brilliant.
Yeah. I think we've lost so much with theater culture that We've lost so much of theater culture.
Oh, it's gone.
Yeah. There's just, I mean, and there's probably no way to bring it back that way. You couldn't get people to sit still for that long.
No.
But, I mean, I went to see Lawrence of Arabia in 70mm at the Lightbox last week, I guess, and it was a full house. I had to sit in the front row. I didn't mind. It was actually, I'd never seen the film from that angle, so I was fine with it. But it was amazing that people would come out on a Thursday afternoon. It was like a 1 o'clock show. It was the last show of Lawrence. They were doing 4 dates for it. And clearly everybody who'd missed it in the last 3 was there. But it was fantastic. It was a full crowd.
Wow.
People were engaging with Omar Sharif and just...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of my favorite movies. I've seen it theatrically half a dozen times now.
Well, I haven't seen that in a long time.
No.
It's good?
Yeah, it holds up. It's just magnificent. You know, you don't feel the running time. You just... And the you see it in The Searchers as well. The sense that there's no artifice, there's no digital anything. You know, when the camel is a mile from the camera, it's a mile from the camera.
Yeah.
You can't fake that stuff. And the locations in The Searchers, as harsh as the lighting is, and maybe as studio stitched as some of the costumes looked, they're still riding horses and doing all the stunts. Yeah. That's all real.
Yeah.
It's a world that's gone in so many ways.
Yeah. The other thing that hits me always is how emotional it is.
Mm.
Like, it brings you to tears, like, from 15 minutes in. And it keeps doing it over and over. And that push, that emotional push, is so strong, you know, from his quest.
Yeah.
And you feel it all the time, every minute. That's a magic act.
Yeah. I was thinking about it this time, and it starts with, I mean, first there's the raising of the homestead, where we really just see flames and burning and nothing. You know, don't go in. We're constantly being told not to look at things.
Yeah.
Don't go in there. There's nothing for him to see. Yeah. I don't make me tell you anymore.
That's right.
It's...
Oh, and boy, and the climax of that is with when Jeffrey Hunter is going to go save her, right? And he says, "Don't make me. There's something I've been meaning to tell you," right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was
your mother's scalp, right, on that lance. Jeffrey Hunter says, "So what? Doesn't change anything."
Yeah, but it's the difference between someone who's seen horror and someone who hasn't.
Yeah,
right? Like it's. It's partially, we were talking about this earlier, it's the restrictions of the 50s where you really couldn't show the kind of carnage that you can see now in film.
Yeah, aren't you thankful for that?
Well, I don't think Ford would have wanted to anyway.
No.
I don't think that's who he was.
No.
Like, it's more disturbing when you can't see it. And the one thing that stood out to me about Lawrence this time is just how brightly red the blood is in an almost artificial way. Because there isn't much, but when you see it, it's not real.
Yeah.
And in here, in The Searchers, you see almost no blood.
No.
But it's implied that it's too awful to look at, which is worse.
Yeah.
Which makes it so much worse.
Yeah. That's right. It's when he's trying to shoot all the buffalo.
Yeah.
Right? So they can't eat him. Right? He doesn't show the buffalo going down.
No.
No. It's just him shooting.
Yeah, and that's worse because he's carrying it. He's just doing this awful thing, shooting out the dead man's eyes so you can't. And that's great too because it tells you that Ethan knows so much about these people that he loathes that he'll defile them in a specific way.
Right.
And he's also dismissive of the Reverend. Like, he's throwing away Christianity to do this thing, and neither of the blasphemies holds him. Like, they don't settle on him. It's just a casual thing that Wayne is doing in performance. It's like, yeah, well, this is what you do to make them hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that just tells me about how long he's been living with this.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't bother him that it's just protocol.
Mm-hmm.
This ugly life he's living.
Well, yeah. I mean, now it's all kept from us, right? Mm-hmm. But the same thing is going on a massive scale everywhere. And I think that's why the movie's so great. It's about things that are in everyone, yeah. You know. But now we don't have movies about that kind of thing, you know. We have movies referring to it, you know, or
sort of arm's length from it.
Yeah, yeah. Sort of redos of, you know.
Yeah, no, it's, well, I mean, you can't tell original stories anymore. There seems to be no market for it. So, you know, it's easier to bake 70s conspiracy theories into a Captain America movie or
yeah.
that way. And then you still have the patina of superheroes where nothing is real and it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious to see how Black Panther handles the racial stuff that's bound to be
oh,
there.
My God.
Right? Like, it's always been in the Marvel stuff, but
yeah.
maybe Ryan Coogler can bring it out.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you know, that cast is going to do something. They'll be committed on some level to
mm-hmm.
finding a truth.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know where we go next. I mean, the industry is in this schism where micro-budget stuff can get made and huge stuff can get made, but nothing in the middle, which seems to clear out the possibility of,
yeah,
you know, character studies and psychological That's explorations right. on any, like, you can't make a period movie for no money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do you re-engage with something like The Searchers? You do it the way Koenig did, which is shoot it in a Calouette and make it its own thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't imagine trying to remake it straight anyway. There's no point, right?
No, you couldn't. It would be ugly.
Maybe we need it to be.
Be unwatchable, I mean.
Oh, I see.
I mean, trying to recreate that. To try to get 200 or 300 guys on horseback who are that great. I mean, they're all like great riders.
I wonder if the stunt teams even exist anymore. That is anyone working at that scale? You can do it all digitally now, so why would you need
Well, it people? All depends on demand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. We should leave The Searchers as it is.
I think so.
Outside. Yeah.
I don't think we need another one.
My thanks to Stephen McCaddy, who you can see opposite Kathleen Monroe, Melanie Scrofano, and friends of the show Kara G and Gracelyn Kung in Peter Lynch's Birdland, opening theatrically in Toronto this Friday, January 26th, the same day it goes live on various VOD platforms in the US and Canada, including iTunes, Amazon Video, and Google Play. Thanks also to Cynthia Amston. She knows what she did. You can find Stephen on Twitter at Stephen McCaddy, all one word, but you'll also notice he's never used the account, which seems somehow fitting. He's pretty old school. You can absolutely find The Searchers on Blu-ray and DVD in a fine special edition from Warner Home Entertainment. It's also on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps. It truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.
All of those, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.